upright. We are in Ecclesiastes chapter 1. We talked about the first 11 verses, kind of this introductory poem that summarizes a lot of the message of the book of Ecclesiastes last time. And I said we'd move a little bit more quickly in the future and then gave you a chunk to read into chapter 2. And actually, we're going to move even faster than I thought we were. I'm going to try to get through chapter 2. There's less of a break there than I was initially thinking in terms of what's being talked about. We'll see how it goes, of course. But really what begins in chapter 1 and verse 12 is what I like to call the experiment, or something along those lines. And basically, it is the preacher deciding that he is going to seek meaning in life through a variety of different kinds of things that we will see him work through over the course of the latter half of chapter 1 and chapter 2, and he evaluates all of it to see what kind of conclusions he can come to from these various kinds of things. And so at the end of chapter 1, he talks about wisdom in particular, and with it, madness and folly. In chapter 2, verses 1 through 11, he talks about pleasure and what it can bring as well. And then toward the end of chapter 2, it's more of a reflection and contemplation of what he has been through over the course of all of this. And so this is kind of his hands-on experiment to find meaning in life, to find satisfaction, however you want to try to describe that. And so that's what we're going to be working our way through today. So chapter 1, beginning in verse 12. I, the preacher, have been king over Israel in Jerusalem, and I applied my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. It is an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. I have seen everything that is done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and a striving after wind. What is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be counted. I said in my heart, I have acquired great wisdom, surpassing all who were over Jerusalem before me. And my heart has had great experience of wisdom and knowledge, and I applied my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceived that this also is but a striving after wind. For in much wisdom is much vexation, and he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. And so a couple of things in this first section of the text. Notice he says at the outset he seeks by wisdom, it says there in verse 13. He wants to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. And so this is kind of the scope of the search that he is doing right at the outset to find everything that is done under heaven. Again, I think the idea is to find some meaning in life, something other than this vanity that he's been talking about and that he's going to continue to talk about. And so he wants to seek after everything. And that's going to have, I think, something of a suggestive force in it as well. That if he is truly seeking out everything, however hyperbolic that might be, the idea is he is going to be as exhaustive as he possibly can. If he is truly seeking out everything, then that really doesn't leave much option of there being anything other than his conclusions. There's not any new facts that are going to come to light later on if he has really sought out everything. Well, you say, well, maybe he did a poor job of searching out everything. He saw everything. He experienced everything. But he wasn't too terribly bright about it. And he came to the wrong kinds of conclusions about the things that he searched and he sought out. But no, we've already, you know, been acquainted with this idea of his great wisdom. And he says he applied his heart to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. And so to seek and search out everything, to do it well, which is his goal, and I think that the implication of Ecclesiastes is he succeeded in that goal of seeking out everything that he sought to seek out. He did it by wisdom. And this is his conclusion, and what that means is that his conclusion is going to be your conclusion as well. Because you can't do the search better than he did. You can't do it more thoroughly than he did. You think, well, maybe I'll find something different in today's society than he would have found back then. But again, remember what we just talked about. Is there a thing of which it is said, see, this is new. It has been already in the ages before us. There's nothing new under the sun. And so that fact, on top of everything else, means that his conclusions are the conclusions. And what he concludes in verse 14 is, all that is done under the sun. And so there is that key phrase again. What he's talking about is life on the earth. Life as we live it here. You might say life apart from God. People talk about it that way sometimes. Or it might just be life on the earth even with God seems to be this way sometimes. You've probably experienced that at some point in your life. But life under the sun, life on this earth, is vanity and striving after wind. Now that idea of vanity, again, as we talked about last time, sometimes it's interpreted to mean futility, sometimes it's interpreted to mean transience or brevity or breath-like, life is a vapor kind of idea. But this idea of striving after the wind, we've not really talked about that much. That comes up here. It's going to come up in verse 17 as well. Striving after wind. What that is to suggest is that it's a pointless endeavor. You think about going out and trying to catch the wind. Now, there are two things about trying to catch the wind. First of all, you can't do it. It's not something that can be caught and kept. So it can't be done, which is part of what makes it pointless. And then even if you did somehow manage to catch it, what you would have is a whole lot of nothing. And so it can't be done, and if you did do it, it's still an act of futility. It's an act of pointlessness. And that's the idea of this image of striving after the wind, trying to catch the wind. And that's a way that he talks about what this life is kind of like, this life under the sun in particular. And so first he says he sought out all that is done by wisdom. And then notice as he continues on, he says he's going to search out wisdom itself. This is one of the first levels of this search and this experiment, is to see what meaning wisdom in itself can provide. I have acquired great wisdom, surpassing all who were over Jerusalem before me. And I applied my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. And I perceive this is also but a striving after wind. And so what he says is, I sought out wisdom to see what meaning there is in wisdom. And then kind of by extension, the other side of that, madness and folly, which he'll come to in more detail later on. But in particular, he sought out wisdom. And what he says is there is no ultimate satisfaction in wisdom under the sun either. It doesn't satisfy. It doesn't bring the kind of lasting meaning that you can hope it would find. Again, you look at someone like this and you say, well, if he can't find meaning through wisdom, then who can? And here is someone who's not just wise. He's wise, and he's wealthy, and he's powerful, and he has all kinds of things that anyone could possibly imagine. Some people would say, well, yeah, if you have wisdom, that's not that great. You need all this other stuff, too. Well, he's got all that other stuff, too. And the wisdom with those things isn't satisfying him. Now, this isn't to say that wisdom is completely useless. That wisdom is completely meaningless. And this is another one of those points where I think it's helpful to stop and think about that word vanity from different kinds of perspectives, at least, because he is using his wisdom to come to this very important conclusion that wisdom is vanity. And so if wisdom was worthless completely, if it was futile completely, then it wouldn't lead him to the wise conclusions that he's coming to. And he's going to go on to say on top of that, that wisdom is better than folly when we get into chapter 2 as well. And so it's not that it is completely useless, but that it can't bring ultimate satisfaction in life. It can't solve the evils of the world. It doesn't bring meaning under the sun. And as he'll talk about later on, it is something that is transient. It is temporary, not lasting. However wise you might be, he's going to say later on, you're going to die just like the fool dies. And so there is that transience to it as well. And so he says this is striving after the wind. Now, he says, again, this hint of madness and folly there in verse 17. This is kind of a foreshadowing of what we're going to see in chapter 2, basically. He's keeping an eye on the alternatives. He knows wisdom is not the only path of life that someone can take. And so as he seeks out wisdom, he keeps an eye on the alternatives, madness and folly as well. And, you know, the fact that he's keeping an eye on the alternatives, the fact that he's not finding meaning and satisfaction in wisdom is kind of anticipating the experiment with pleasure that chapter 2 is going to begin with as well. All right, thoughts about the first few verses here, 12 through 18, Charlie? I would have to look at the other context. Tom, you have anything off the top of your head there? You said Hosea 12?
Yeah, 12. In the very context, but Simeon and Ephraim being deceitful, and I think that's a common Hebrew phrase that meant more than it does in the English translation.
You talk about verse 1 there?
Yeah.
Ephraim feeds on the wind is what my translation says. Pursues the east wind all day long.
Yeah. My translation says he's all feeding on the wind. And then it has that footnote
to cross over. Okay. Yeah, I don't know offhand if there's any significance there. It may not even be exactly the same wording in the original. I'd have to look at that too. So, or not. Adam?
Mm-hmm. And I'm noticing it looks like the word wisdom seems to be used a little different here, like in verse 18. It's not necessarily a spiritual kind of wisdom that he's talking about, more just a kind of an earthly wisdom, I guess, that he's talking about here.
Yeah, that's the impression that I get as well. And that's something that, I mean, if you think about it in New Testament terms, James, for example, contrasts the wisdom from above and the wisdom from below. And this entire idea of being framed as what is wisdom of all that is done under heaven there in verse 13. If we understand under heaven to be roughly synonymous with under the sun, then this is wisdom under the sun. I probably should have said that specifically. It's in my notes. And also, there is for a wisdom book to get into this section that is specifically talking about how wise he is, and his seeking out things by wisdom, and his seeking out wisdom itself, and it to never mention the fear of the Lord in this context is, I think, a notable point that kind of emphasizes this is a different sort of wisdom. This is this earthly kind of wisdom. I think that's right. Jonathan? Yeah, it certainly is, and how you would assess that probably has some to do with how you would who you would understand this preacher to be, in particular. And we talked way back when about there being, you know, some believers, and this isn't just a crazy liberal theory. I mean, some believers take this not to be Solomon specifically, and it's, you know, kind of putting on the Solomon hat to teach the lessons of Solomon, and the emphasis on his great wisdom, greater than anyone before him, is kind of a way of identifying these as the lessons of Solomon, is what someone from that perspective might say. Someone who takes it to be Solomon specifically. Again, since he never comes right out and says, I'm Solomon, it may still have kind of some of that self-identifying aspect to it. Or it could, I think, just be the idea of credentials, like you said. I am trying to show something that is going to have, no loopholes. I didn't miss anything. We're not talking about something where you can say, well, but what about this? There is no what about this. I'm the wisest person ever. I sought everything by wisdom, and these are the conclusions, and there's nothing new under the sun, so this is the answer to everything. Maybe because it's such a different kind of perspective. I've never really thought about that question specifically, so this is just kind of as I think about it now. But one of the things that you notice is the general tone of Ecclesiastes is very different from the general tone of Proverbs. Now, Proverbs will talk about, the righteous, wise person who's, crops are taken away from him by the evil of someone else, and he'd be great, and he'd be doing just fine, except someone else was evil. So Proverbs acknowledges that bad things happen. But the general tone of Proverbs is much more optimistic, much more focusing on the value of wisdom and the benefit of wisdom. And for someone to come along and say, wisdom, that's nothing, that's vanity, striving after wind. Toil, that's vanity, that's striving after wind. Wealth, that's vanity. Everything all the way down the line. The fact that the tone of the book is so different may be part of why he feels the need to solidify himself along those lines. But I don't know, that's a good question. Dan?
Could it be the time period? It seems that it's the same wisdom to me, and there's grief in that. There's grief in folly. There's grief in wisdom. And whereas this is talking about what's the end of your life here on earth, you're going to die. Okay, so, sure you were wise, sure you're foolish, you're going to die. Whereas in Proverbs, it was more day-to-day type things. Here's the things that will help you, but you're still going to have grief. When you get to Ecclesiastes, you see, it all ends up, you're going to die. And so, if you're looking at that, the end of man here on earth,
right.
It doesn't really, you're going in the grave, it's like,
Yeah, I think that's right. The focus of each of the books is very different, and that's why the tone seems different. I think you're right. It's not that they're saying polar opposite things that can't be reconciled with one another. If you look at the perspective of the two books and what the books are dealing with in particular, that helps some of that tension out significantly. Some of it is just, seeing the reality of Proverbs. Proverbs is not just happy-go-lucky all the time. It faces the difficult realities of life too, not as thoroughly as Ecclesiastes does, but the point of each book of the Bible is not to be an exhaustive discussion of everything that could ever be talked about. So, keep in mind the focus, and death very much is this constant companion through the book of Ecclesiastes. It shows up over and over and over again, sometimes pretty clearly, sometimes more subtly, and then when you get to the end, this is all coming to a conclusion. That's what you get, is this very clear picture of the end of life. And so that very much is a focus here. Tom?
I'm kind of reminded of Paul in Philippians 3, who goes on bragging, line after line about how great he is, the Hebrews, and all of that, but his very purpose is to say, well, that's all worth nothing. And so if perspective of Ecclesiastes is such wisdom is nothing, and to say, yeah, I had all wisdom and all money, and that wisdom's nothing, money's nothing, so it's not bragging anymore, because your very point is all this is nothing.
Guy?
The word folly and famine books are both used in the book, but what is the definition of it? Why
enjoyment. And in any of that, certainly Solomon had many things to, quote, enjoy that satisfied his desires, legitimate, maybe illegitimate. And likewise with the poor, why is life all folly and vanity? Is it because it ends in death? Well, that doesn't entirely make sense to me. So it seems to me there's something more in this folly and vanity than may appear on the surface. Yeah. My observation.
Sure. Greg, were you going to say something?
Just that I think that because of the conclusion of the book, maybe that's why he's justifying himself and his experience. I looked at all these other things.
All right, pressing on then into chapter 2. I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure, enjoy yourself. But behold, this also was vanity. I said of laughter, it is mad, and of pleasure, what use is it? I searched with my heart how to cheer my body with wine, my heart still guiding me with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly, till I might see what was good for the children of man to do under heaven during the few days of their life. I made great works. I built houses and planted vineyards for myself. I made myself gardens and parks and planted them all kinds of fruit trees. I made myself pools from which to water the forest of growing trees. I bought male and female servants and had slaves who were born in my house. I had also great possessions of herds and flocks, more than any who had been before me in Jerusalem. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. I got singers, both men and women, and many concubines, the delight of the children of man. So I became great and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also my wisdom remained with me, and whatever my eyes desired I did not keep from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure, for my heart found pleasure in all my toil. And this was my reward for all my toil. Then I considered all that my hands had done and the toil that I had expended in doing it. And behold, all was vanity and a striving after wind. And there was nothing to be gained under the sun. And so now he seeks out pleasure. So again, wisdom, madness, and folly. Wisdom failed. Now we get into madness and folly, it seems. And he says, laughter is mad, pleasure is useless. And the difference between those two things, if there is a significant difference, maybe that laughter is this more superficial sort of happiness. A laugh is nice while you have it, but it's not something that lasts long. It's not something that gives you any kind of enduring satisfaction. It's great in the moment, but it's really a pretty superficial sort of thing. Pleasure is something that may be a little bit more deeper, joy, gladness of heart and mind, but that's not helpful really either. And the point isn't that laughter and pleasure are somehow wrong, but that they do not satisfy in the long run. They do not solve the problems of life. They do not solve the evils of the world. When you look for meaning under the sun, they don't provide that either. And it's not that the preacher never commends those things, because he does and he will, but that the pursuit of those things for the hope of gain, for the hope of meaning, for the hope of ultimate satisfaction, that is just as pointless is anything else. And so these kinds of things aren't going to bring the solution either. And so he begins with his answer, and you find this pretty frequently in Ecclesiastes, that he says, I'm going to be talking about this for a while, and the very first thing he says is, he gives away the answer at the beginning, which, you know, we think is bad for drama, but that's kind of how they do things. They summarize the conclusion and then work their way through it. So after the conclusion there in the first two verses, he gets into some of the details. Wine, first of all, and how to lay hold of folly. Those two things go together pretty well, right? Drinking and foolishness. But notice he does say that, if I may paraphrase, I'm not just going off the deep end crazy here. I'm actually trying to assess these things and see if they bring any satisfaction. So while he drinks, he doesn't just drink to get drunk. He drinks wisely, if you may say so. At least that's what he says. My heart's still guiding me with wisdom as he seeks how to cheer his body with wine there in verse 3. And the same thing, I think, goes through the rest of this as well. His wisdom remained with him, he says, at the end of this section. Again, emphasizing that he's not just going nuts with this, but trying to find meaning through experimenting with these things. Various great works, houses and vineyards, gardens and parks, pools in a forest. And it's a striking thing when you look at great leaders and great rulers and the sorts of things you see them doing quite frequently. And one of the things you see them always doing is building great gardens in the midst of their cities. And I've mentioned this before. This is one of those things that I had pointed out to me by Phil Roberts while he was around. And it's just this striking thing that the greatest cities that are ever built, they plant these gardens. And it's this inner longing for what has been lost. And they don't even really know, don't even realize that they're longing for this. And here in particular, I mean, it's not a specific description of the Garden of Eden, but as you read through this, you've got this great garden with all kinds of trees and its own water source and male and female slaves is what he talks about. But that phrase, male and female, right in the he's populating his garden. And it's this, you know, latent garden desire that is in humanity. And perhaps it's described this way to remind us of what is missing and why you're not going to find satisfaction in all these things, because that satisfaction is removed with sin in the next chapter of the book of Genesis. And that's what has brought all of this vanity and futility to the earth. And then you add to that people in wealth in verses 7 and 8, male and female slaves, musicians, singers, concubines. I mean, when you've got singers, concubines, and wine, what you're talking about is the ancient equivalent of sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And that's what he is going through that aspect of the search at this point. And he finds, you know, more of the same. But notice a couple of things here as well. In verse 4, I made great works. I built houses and planted vineyards for myself. Notice in verse 8, I also gathered for myself silver and gold, the treasure of kings and provinces. There's nothing humanitarian or philanthropic going on in any of this that he's doing. This is for myself that he is going through this process. It's a very self-centered sort of perspective. He does indicate in verse 3 and then later as well, again, that his heart is guiding him with wisdom, that he is trying to truly evaluate these things. And the conclusions then, he comes back to them again at the end. He started with the conclusions. He concludes with the conclusions as well. He was greater than all who were before him in Jerusalem in verse 9. His wisdom remained with him. Again, he doesn't just go berserk. The problem wasn't a lack of self-restraint, but a lack of these things providing any kind of real satisfaction. The scope of the experiment is emphasized again in verse 10. I kept from my heart no pleasure. Anything he wanted, he sought some kind of satisfaction in that. The reference to his eyes in verse 10, and then his heart as well in verse 10. Whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. Whatever my heart, or I kept from my heart, no pleasure. Seems to emphasize the internal and external dimensions of things. Whatever he felt, whatever he saw, he indulged in all of those things. Whether it would be visibly entertaining or inwardly satisfying, he sought all of those things, and he found that to be vanity and striving after wind as well. All right. Thoughts about the first 11 verses of chapter 2 there? Yeah. Yeah, that kind of, it's very self-centered kind of focus. Laura, were you going to say something? It does. Yeah, and that I think is a fantastic point. That's one of the great lessons of Ecclesiastes, is if you look for meaning in life and answers to life's great questions in these kinds of physical things apart from anything else, you're going to find it wanting. And there are just so many examples of this. If I spent a week researching all of the wealthy people who were unhappy, good grief, what a list that would be, right? Whether they're movie stars or athletes or musicians or intellectual giants or whatever it may be. I mean, you could look at any corner of the world and find the most famous, most wealthy, most accomplished, whatever it is in any field, what you'll find is a whole load of unhappiness. Now, not everybody in every circumstance, of course, is going to be that way, but you find a whole lot of unhappiness as people look to those kinds of things to bring them satisfaction. And if you look to those things to provide satisfaction, you're not going to find it, and it's going to be as depressing as Ecclesiastes sounds sometimes. You find that it doesn't provide what you're looking for. You need something beyond that. And I think that emphasizes the fact that we were created for something more than what there is just on the earth, at least the cursed earth that we are a part of now. Dan, were you going to say something?
Does he address serving others at all?
He will talk about serving others at least a little bit. I'm trying to remember specifically when that comes up. At this point, it's pretty self-centered. It's going to be later in the book. You remember he takes on the persona of various people. There's a while where he's kind of the peasant that can't stop the king from doing bad things. And there's, one spot where he uses feminine pronouns, which seem to indicate he's taking a womanly kind of perspective about things. So it's going to be in one of these later sections, but I don't know that he ever devotes a thorough amount of the text to this is the meaning you find in serving others. You're not going to see that. And I don't even remember offhand how much time he speaks about it, if it's really explicit or more implicit. But I at least seem to remember that idea coming up somewhere along the way.
The section that starts in verse 18 and follows that somewhat, at least implicitly, to the idea of, is there value, is there profit in doing things for others? He speaks about how he thinks that all this labor is that it's pointless because ultimately somebody else is going to get it all and there's no lasting benefit there to it. So he acknowledges that other people can benefit from his labor and still says, well, there's not really any great lasting profit there. And that was another thing I was thinking about from this section we are discussing at the moment, that he says in verse 11 that you're striving after work, there's no profit under the sun. He doesn't say that there was no pleasure at all in all these things. It's not that he didn't enjoy them temporarily, but that there was no kind of enduring meaning or value in this.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think if he was sitting here with us and we could talk to him, I guess we would have to speak Hebrew. But if he was here and we could talk to him, or maybe he could speak English, that'd be easier. He would say, I found some temporary pleasure in these things. But the idea isn't, does it satisfy for 5 minutes? It's, does it satisfy for a life? Does it answer the questions that we're all seeking to find the answers to? And the answer to that, of course, is no, those things don't provide that.
The distinction that often gets overlooked in the world at large. People confuse, does this temporarily please me with, does this make my life meaningful or satisfactory?
And
they chase after things looking for the latter and only finding the former.
Right, and that kind of goes back to what Laurel was saying as well, is, you look at the world today, and you see a lot of this, and I think what you're saying there is right, is it's not that they can't find, 15 minutes of satisfaction in, drinking some really nice wine, but tomorrow, how do you feel about it? Not just, do you have a hangover, but, did that really answer the problems of life? And of course the answer is no. And whether it's wine or achievements or fame or knowledge or whatever the case is, it doesn't provide those ultimate answers. All right, verses 12 through 26, we won't take the time to read all of this, but again, this kind of is his more contemplative section of thinking through this. I turn to consider wisdom and madness and folly. And so this is what he has been seeking through, is wisdom, madness, and folly. Now he's looking back at it and considering it, looking at it from a different kind of perspective. And he kind of reminds us of this nothing new under the sun kind of perspective at the end of verse 12. What can the man do who comes after the king? Only what has been done before. So you know, he is the king in question. And what he's saying to you is, what are you going to do different from what I have done? And the answer is nothing. So if you engage in this search as well, I take this to mean, if you engage in this search, you're only going to find the same answers that I found, which is all is vanity and striving after wind. And so what are his conclusions? Well, wisdom is better than folly, he says in verses 13 and 14. But it still doesn't answer everything. But while you're here, while you're living under the sun, wisdom is better than folly. It's just not the ultimate solution to all of the problems of life. But wisdom is not the answer because, again, wisdom is transient. Wisdom is a vapor like life is a vapor. And again, remember, that's kind of the literal meaning of this word vanity, is breath-like. And whether that means futile or whether it means temporary is I think, something of a debatable point. But here, at least, wisdom is vain because wisdom is breath-like, because it's going to end. It's short. The wise and the fool are going to die just the same. And so under the sun, death is the great equalizer. Doesn't matter if you're, you know, wealthy or poor, famous or a nobody, wise or foolish, everyone is going to die at the end. And so wisdom might, on the one hand, seem like it has potential to be the answer. Death renders it moot. And so it's, you know, the final analysis, in a sense, wisdom and folly are equal because neither one can save you from death. And all are forgotten. Even the wise is forgotten, just like the fool is forgotten. And he concludes there in verse 17, then, so I hated life, because what is done under the sun was grievous to me, for all is vanity and a striving after wind. It's interesting that he doesn't say, I hated my life. You know, that's what you hear a lot of depressed people say, is I hate my life. This is not depression in any kind of sense that we would typically think about it. He's not focused on how bad his life is. He's focused on life, generally speaking. This is how life as an enterprise is, and I hate it. It has a suggestive force that, you know, yeah, my life is worth hating, but your life is worth hating too. Seems to be kind of the general perspective. Now, again, remember the perspective here is this under the sun perspective, where all is vanity. And then he turns at the end of this chapter here to talk about toil specifically. And toil is something that is vain as well. There's nothing to be found in wisdom, madness, and folly. He tries toil, but he hated his toil as well there in verse 18. Because, again, another is going to get the results of what you've labored to achieve. And that might mean that you work and give and someone else gets it. Or it might mean you work and work and work and die and someone else inherits it. And with death being our constant companion through Ecclesiastes, that seems like it could very well be the idea that is emphasized there. You know, your daily work is what has been at least temporarily entrusted to you, and your job passes on to the next person who will follow you, and that person may just be a complete bumbling buffoon that doesn't know how to do anything and ruins everything you spent your life trying to achieve. And how awful that would be. I mean, you'll be dead and won't know the difference, but still, I mean, you work and work and work and work to accomplish something and build something, and someone comes along after you and just tears it down in a week. And you think about how depressing of a thought that is. And so your work, your skill, your intelligence, your toil is ultimately nullified by your death. And so there's nothing really to be gained by this except bad things. Notice in verses 22 and 23, what has a man from all the toiling and striving of heart with which he toils beneath the sun? For all his days are full of sorrow, and his work is a vexation. Even in the night his heart does not rest. This also is vanity. So you gain nothing for all your work except sorrow, stress, and insomnia. That's what you get for your toil and for your labor. You've overloaded your days with work and overloaded your nights with worry is what it amounts to. But then all of a sudden, he takes a little bit of a different view. And all of a sudden, God is in the equation when you get to verses 24 through 26. There's nothing better for a person than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. Wait a second, I thought you just said toil was completely worthless. Well, when toil is self-centered, when it is for the pursuit of profit, that is when toil is worthless. But notice here, the perspective changes from seeking profit to receiving a gift. This also I saw is from the hand of God. From apart from Him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? For to the one who pleases Him, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy, but to the sinner He has given the business of gathering and collecting, only to give to one who pleases God. This also is vanity and a striving after wind. So if you look at life kind of out from under the sun, so to speak, you look, take a different perspective, then you can find enjoyment in your toil, as you can with eating and drinking. You can enjoy simple pleasures as simple pleasures if you understand that they're simple pleasures. But what you cannot do is enjoy simple pleasures as ultimate answers to the deep questions of life, because they can't do that. And they will not provide that, and it will only depress you if you try to find those answers in those things. But if you understand that those are simple pleasures that are gifts from God and receive them as that and celebrate them as that, then they can provide that pleasure in that moment at least. Let's stop there. I've talked too much. So thoughts about any of these last sections here that I've kind of rushed through? Jonathan. I think that's a fair thing to say. There may not have been a single person who did as much as he did, but in the conglomerate, yeah.
And then think about verse 16, there's no remembrance of the wise man, as the fool. Could that point to part of why, regardless of who the author of this is, why he wouldn't include his name? It almost highlights the fact that nobody remembers, you know, I'm just some old dead wise guy, no one remembers me anyway.
That perhaps, yeah. Right. That's a good thought. What else here? Well, let me note one more thing before we run out of time. Chapter 2 and verse 26, we've run into this idea of what God has given before, but I want to emphasize this here. To the one who pleases Him, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy, but to the sinner He has given the business of gathering and collecting, only to give to the one who pleases God. Flip back to chapter 1 and verse 13. Here He says, I applied my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. It is an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. What He says in 1:13 is everything, all that is done, that's the point under the context of what's being discussed, all that is done is this unhappy business that God has given. Now here, as He takes this different approach and His different look on what's going on, He sees something different. God does give, but He doesn't give everyone this unhappy business. He gives the one who pleases Him, the one that has the right outlook on life, these simple pleasures, including wisdom and knowledge and joy. But the sinner is the one that He gives the unhappy business to. the unhappy business of gathering and collecting to ultimately give to someone else. And so much of this, I think, does come back to this perspective. What are you looking to find in life? And if you're looking to life itself for ultimate meaning, you're going to find it wanting and you're going to find it very unsatisfying. But if you accept life as it is and find the simple pleasures where you can find the simple pleasures and keep your focus elsewhere for the ultimate meaning in life, then you can be the one that pleases God and find the simple pleasures and not be overwhelmed with sorrow for looking to the wrong thing. Greg? Yes. And again, there is that contrast, I think, of the self-centered pursuit of profit that we saw in so much of chapter 2 with this receiving a gift here at the end of chapter 2. All right. Well, thank you for your thoughts today. This is the chapter that we'll probably divide it up a little bit more. Chapter 3 next time, we'll look at the first 15 verses. Because the issue of justice done under the sun at the end of chapter 3 very clearly goes with the beginning of chapter 4. So both to keep things a little bit briefer and not get have to rush so much, and also for the sake of the context, we'll look at verses 1 through 15 of chapter 3 next time.